Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for December 25th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. It's our final podcast of 2009, and this one is all about the favorite stories of the year from Science's online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Each year, the Science Now team puts together their top 10 stories from the year, and David Grimm, editor of Science Now, is here with a selection from that top 10 list. Not the whole list, David?
No, Rob, I wanted to leave something to the imagination, so we're just going to give you five of our favorite stories from the year, and you'll have to go to the website to see what the other five are.
So what constitutes a top 10 story? What makes the cut?
Well, Rob, these stories are a selection of some of our favorite stories of the year, so some staff favorites, mixed in with some of the most popular stories of the year in terms of how many people actually read these stories. And a lot of times they overlap, but sometimes they don't.
Okay, so what's first?
Well, Rob, this first story is a story that does overlap. This is one of our most popular stories of the year that was actually one of my personal favorites. It's about a New Zealand tree that is stuck in a time warp.
I remember the story, something about it having outlived its predators.
Exactly. Well, what scientists have found with this tree, which is called the Lancewood tree, and it grows on the Chatham Islands, which are about 800 kilometers east of New Zealand. So sort of an isolated area. And what's interesting about the tree is it has all these strange adaptations. It has these leaves that look like spears on certain stages of its life cycle. Its leaves actually resemble dead leaves on the ground. And to make a long story short, all of these adaptations seem very specific for protecting this plant against a moa, which was this giant flightless bird that died out about 500 years ago. And even though this predator that in the theory goes used to munch on the Lancewood tree is long gone, this tree is still producing all of these adaptations against it. So it's still defending itself against this predator that went extinct a long time ago. And so that's why we say this tree is sort of stuck in a time warp, because the Lancewood tree still thinks it's 500 years ago and it hasn't really caught up to the present time.
So the adaptations, while perhaps not beneficial anymore in terms of protecting it from the moa, aren't detrimental to its survival.
That seems to be the case. And actually, there's a very robust discussion, or there was a very robust discussion, which you can still read going on in the comment section of this article, with people arguing, well, is this a case of evolution gone awry, or is this actually something far more simpler going on? So you have to check out the story and read the comments. They're very amusing.
Okay, so what's next?
Well, Rob, speaking of time, this next story is about a hard drive that could potentially last a billion years.
Another one we've talked about on the podcast.
It is. And when we say a billion years, we're talking about almost permanent data storage. You know, those Facebook updates that you do and the tweets that you are Twittering, imagine that those could technically still be around a billion years from now. This story is all about some of the limitations of our current data storage technology, like DVDs succumb to something called DVD rot, which can actually happen fairly quickly. And once that happens, the DVD is destroyed. Even the other digital methods of encoding data that we have right now are actually a lot more temporary than we'd like to think. Problems with everything from magnetism to sun exposure, things like this can actually really limit the length for which we can store data right now. And so scientists have come up with this new way, which is more permanent than encoding things magnetically.
So how's this work?
Well, this has to do with these carbon nanotubes. And you can actually see a video of what's going on in the story. But basically what's happening is that the researchers made these tiny little carbon nanotubes, and they put these nanoparticles in them, and the nanoparticle moves from one side of the nanotube to the other. And if you think about how binary data storage works, if the nanoparticle was on one part of the tube, it would encode maybe a 1, and if it was on the other part of the tube, it would encode a 0. But you really have this physical way to encode data, which the researchers say could last millions, even a billion, even to the end of the universe type of data storage.
And what causes it to switch from a 1 to a 0? What makes it move?
It's an electric current that makes these tiny little nanoparticles move back and forth. But once they're there, they don't move. So it's essentially, again, this idea of permanent data storage.
I'm not sure I would want all my Facebook updates or tweets kept around that long.
Well, that's the potential downside of this technology. If there's ever something that appeared on the internet that you didn't want to save for future generations. This might work against that. So beware when this technology actually comes out.
Okay. So what's the next story here?
Well, Rob, take a listen to this.
What's that screeching sound?
Well, speaking of billion-year data storage, Rob, this is a video that you actually might want to keep around for a very long time. What you're hearing is an audio clip of a video of a bird named Snowball, who is dancing to the Backstreet Boys and also squawking a bit, and that's the screech you were hearing.
Why would we want to preserve this for a billion years?
Well, aside from the fact that it's a very fun video to watch, and I encourage you to take a look at it on the site, it actually tells us something about how the human brain might be wired. There was this theory for a long time that only humans had the right neural wiring to be able to allow us to dance in time to music. You know, when we think when we're bipping and bopping to the musical beat, that's something very simple, but it actually involves very complex wiring in our brain. And researchers have thought for a long time, because our brains are so complicated, only humans must be able to do it. But then they saw this video of Snowball and they said, hey, this is not an ability that's just limited to humans. If you look at Snowball, the bird is very clearly dancing in time to the beat. And the researchers actually went to visit Snowball after they had seen this video. And they changed the tempo. They sped it up or slowed it down. And even when they did that, Snowball perfectly matched the tempo of the beat, showing that this wasn't just some sort of trick. Snowball really was able to follow the beat. And since then, the researchers have looked at a whole host of videos, mostly on YouTube. They say they've gone through more than 1,000 YouTube videos of dancing animals, and they've seen dancing with dogs and cats and chimpanzees and elephants and birds and whatnot. And what they found is that the animals that tend to be vocal mimics, like parrots and even elephants, actually elephants have been shown to mimic the noises of trucks in Africa. These animals tend to be most likely to be able to move in time with a beat, suggesting that this link between the vocal part of the brain and motor skills might be necessary for dancing to the beat.
So is this going to help us figure out how our musical ability evolved?
Well, it definitely could. That's the idea here. You know, again, aside from it just being a very fun study, we might actually learn something about how our ability to process music, or maybe even why we invented music in the first place, came about.
Okay. So we're to our fourth story. What's this one about?
Well, Rob, from bird brains to Einstein's brain, this fourth story is about what was it about Einstein's brain that made him so brilliant? And this is obviously a question researchers have been asking themselves ever since the famous physicist passed away several decades ago. And there have been some studies done in the past where people have actually taken, you know, he donated his brain to science, and people have taken slices of the brain and looked, and they've made multiple photographs. But a lot of these early studies were not very conclusive. And so what was done in this 2009 study is a researcher actually looked at a lot of these photographs. So he didn't actually have the brain itself, which was one of the drawbacks of the study, but he had all these historic photographs of regions of the brains and brain slices. And what he was able to see was that he noticed peculiarities in Einstein's brain that may correlate with his incredible mental abilities.
Such as?
Well, for instance, the parietal lobes of Einstein's brain were much larger than average. And these lobes, these regions have been implicated in solving complex mathematical problems. So that seems to go hand in hand. And something else interesting they saw was that Einstein's brain has a pronounced knob-like structure in a part of the motor cortex that controls the left hand. And in other studies, knobs like this have been shown to be associated with musical ability. And as some people know, Einstein played the violin avidly since childhood. So this may explain why he was such a good player.
Now, I understand, though, that Einstein's brain weighed less, had less mass than the normal brain. What was smaller about Einstein's brain?
Well, that's obviously something you wouldn't expect. We always seem to attribute larger brain size to better cognitive abilities, and clearly that was not the case in Einstein's case. But it was really the whole brain as a whole that was just smaller on average than the average human brain. So a lot of interesting stuff coming out of this new analysis that may give us clues to not only how Einstein thought, but how the rest of us think as well.
Okay, so last of the top five, which are just five of the top 10, what's this last one that you're going to talk about with us today?
Well, Rob, speaking of how we think, this last story is about bad decisions and how they may be contagious. And this was one of my favorite stories of the year.
And one we talked about only last month, was it?
Right. This is a very recent story, too. This is actually a study that was published just in November. And what researchers did here was they had a bunch of volunteers play an economic game where some of the players were making really bad decisions. They were trying to outbid another player. And even though it was very clear they were going to lose money, they kept on trying to outbid this other player. So they were making these bad decisions. It was kind of like you or I throwing money into a house, a housing renovation project, even though we know the house isn't going to sell to make up for that. And what the researchers found is that when they had other volunteers monitor these people playing these economic games, the more the volunteer identified with the person that was making the bad decision, in other words, if they had, you know, around the same date of birth or they were in the same year in school or whatever, if they took over from these people, if they said, okay, now I want you to take over for these people that are bidding, they were much more likely to continue making bad decisions, even though they were technically walking into these games very objectively and they knew these people were making bad decisions. Once they started to empathize with these people, they started making the same bad decisions they were making, which indicates that bad decision making might be contagious.
Now, is this known by another name like groupthink or jumping on the bandwagon or something like that?
Exactly. And actually, one of the applications the researchers talk about here is they talk about the recent financial crisis and they talk about a couple of car companies that have done very poorly over the past year. One of these car companies, GM, decided to, you know, really revamp its operations. It wasn't going to hire from within. It was going to take somebody from outside to help run the company. Whereas the other automaker, Ford, hired internally, and they say GM has done a lot better than Ford has. And the reason they say is maybe because this outside thinker wasn't contaminated, for maybe lack of a better word, by all the bad decisions that were being made and could sort of come in objectively, wasn't really empathizing with the other people at the company because wasn't coming from the same background as the other people in the company were coming from. And that alone may have helped the company turn around a lot better than Ford did. And there's, if you look at the comments, there's been some interesting discussions about should we have foreigners come in and help run companies because they're coming from a completely different perspective than maybe the company is used to. So a lot of potential applications for a study like this. And also, again, it's just a really fun study to read about.
Okay, so that wraps up our top five of the top 10. Now, of the top 10, where do these five lie? Are they least favorite or the most favorite or what?
Well, Rob, these are all over the place, but I will tell you this, that the most popular story of the year has not been talked about yet, and you're going to have to check out the site to figure out what that is.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
And have a great holiday.
You too.
So when will we be seeing you back here again?
Well, Rob, Science Now is taking a bit of a holiday, so we won't be publishing the last week of December, but we will be back the beginning of January, and I will be back in here with you discussing our next round of latest and greatest stories, maybe some which will make it into the best of the year for 2010.
And the policy blog, Science Insider?
That will continue running during the holidays.
Okay. We'll see you here again for the January 8th podcast.
See you then, Rob.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can catch up on the latest science news, find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, and find the full top 10 list of the most favorite stories of 2009 at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the December 25th, 2009 special Science Magazine podcast with the favorite stories of the year from science's online daily news site, Science Now. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.